This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to the show. Our guests this episode are record producer Stephen Street, and we take a trip to Savile Row with my old friend Tom Pendry to wear something nice. Which moments in music history would you like to have witnessed? Perhaps you think of some of the notorious ones: Hendrix at Woodstock, the night Bowie killed off Ziggy, Radiohead at Glastonbury. Maybe you've got some more personal ones: the Blue Nile touring Hats, or Otis Redding in 67. But likely you're thinking of moments in the live arena. What about all the moments that took place behind closed doors in recording studios? Today's first guest, Stephen Street, is a record producer who's experienced a lot of great moments. He worked with the Smiths for the majority of their career. He produced several Blur albums, including Park Life, The Great Escape, and the self-titled one. He produced the most well-known Cranberries records, including their most recent, In the End, completed after the death of singer Dolores O'Riordan. He's also worked with Lloyd Cole, New Order, Suede, The Pretenders, Cortinas, The Triffids. He's got some stories. I had such a good time talking with him, and I hope you enjoy it. Hi.
You okay?
Yeah, how are you, mate?
Yeah, all good. Yeah, kind of strange times as we're all in, but there you go.
Yeah, how are you coping?
A bit strange, kind of up and down, really. Sometimes I kind of feel like it's quite a nice relief not to have the pressure of, you know, being in the studio and, you know, kind of, and then other times you just feel like you're kind of cheating yourself, you know? It's kind of, and you just worry also about the general kind of health of the industry, really, how it's going to recover from this. You know, it's pretty scary times.
It feels like it'll be easier to socially distance in a studio, but it's the kind of live industry that it's kind of hard to imagine.
Yeah, I think if you're mixing, it's fine, but if you're actually creating new music, especially the kind of thing that I work on, you know, when I tend to work with bands, you know, when you're kind of right in there amongst the band itself, you know, and kind of, it's quite difficult, really.
Have you got family at home with you?
Well, most of my three kids have got all grown up now, so they're not with us. They've moved out. Yeah, but I'm here with my wife. Yeah, so driving each other mad.
I wanted to ask, because I think you're the first producer that we've had on the show that would define themselves kind of perhaps solely as a producer as opposed to being in a band, etc.
Right.
I wondered how you define what you do, because it's interesting to me that the role of a producer seems to vary so wildly between, say, someone like Rick Rubin, who seems to be more of like a facilitator of music and a psychologist, or someone, you know, like George Martin being a classic example of being very hands-on and perhaps quite directly influencing the creativity of the music. Or then you've got, you know, perhaps in a pop world, someone like Stuart Price or something, their role, again, would be very different.
Yeah.
To either of those, and I wondered what you feel your role is when you go in to make a record, or does it depend on how long you've worked with an artist or who the artist is? Does it change from project to project?
I guess most probably the way I look at it is because of the people who inspired me to get into the job in the first place, which is to say that I was inspired by the advent in the 70s that went on and carried on well into the 80s as well, and still to this day continues, I guess. But it was the advent of the engineer producer.
Right.
I was very inspired by the likes of Martin Rushent, Martin Hannett, John Leckie, Steve Lillywhite, Gil Norton, Tony Visconti was probably as well. I mean, Tony obviously was the first name that really kind of stuck out in my name as a young Bowie and Bolan fan. You know, I was thinking, who is this exotically named guy called Tony Visconti? I always remember making a kind of a mental note of his name. And I was a budding musician in a band, but didn't really kind of get anywhere greatly. I mean, you know, we got a record deal, but nothing came of it, really. But what I did like was the thing of being in the studio. So I kind of thought, well, you know, I've got some musical knowledge. I'm not the most musical kind of, I'm not the most advanced musically, but I do know enough about being in a band and playing as a member of a band. And if I could learn the technical side of recording, if I can learn how to use a recording desk and learn how to kind of get the technical side, if I can put that together with my musical knowledge, then hopefully I could turn it into one of these musical kind of engineer producer types, you know? I wrote to all the recording studios that I could possibly find back in the early 80s. Hardly got any replies initially, and I was getting quite desperate. And I remember phoning, I met at this point, I'd done a session with Jeremy Green, who was the engineer that used to work with Bill Price, another great name. And he said to me, I think Island Records are looking for someone. And I said, well, no, I've written to Basing Street Studios. They said, you know, they're fine, they haven't got any space. He said, no, I think the record company itself has got a small basement studio and they're looking for someone. They're doing a refit at the moment. Perhaps you should give them a call. So I gave them a call and managed to talk them into letting me come and see them. And I managed to get the job. And they were indeed doing a refit at the time of the studio. The studio was called the Fallout Shelter and it was in the basement below Island Records. And I always remember my first job was kind of varnishing the woodwork that was going up on the walls, you know, to create, you know, the panelling for the control room. But I really did feel like I was part of the team, me building the studio. And also, it was a great place to be because, A, the quality of the material you're working on was very good. And B, the engineers I was working with, they were encouraging. They gave me the, you know, I wasn't just a T-boy. You know, I was actually really kind of thrown in the deep end and, you know, setting up microphones and getting to know how all the outboard equipment worked. There was a huge influx of outboard equipment in the early 80s. It was a real big thing, you know, AMS and Lexicon and all these companies were coming through. It was quite exciting times, really. So technology was arriving in, you know, quite a fast rush. And I managed to kind of get, within a couple of years, I was kind of engineering there, you know, Island Records, and that was fantastic. And then that's where I had my big break because that's where I met the Smiths. And as everyone knows in this industry, you do need a lucky break at the right time to kind of get up the ladder, as it were. And that was the big one for me.
There's probably an alternate universe where you ended up working with U2, I guess, being associated with Ireland in the early 80s. That wouldn't have been...
Yeah, or like a lot of, you know, other, you know, great engineers that I've met but never had that break. You just end up doing another job, you know. It's the way it goes sometimes.
Is it a challenge to keep up with the technology, because in your career there's been, you know, it must be unrecognizable from, you know, what a studio looked like in 1980 to the potential in 2020.
It has been, I guess, in a way. I mean, I always remember, you know, obviously when I first started with the Smiths, there were no computers at all, but apart from the SSL desks, so that was the first thing to really get to grips with, was using the, and I got to grips with that pretty well. But that was as much as the computer I wanted to know about. You know, the idea of sitting there staring at a computer screen filled me with horror. One had to keep up initially with some of the advances actually as to the format that we were recording on. I always remember trying to keep up with that, you know, and I wasn't a Luddite in that sense. And in fact, when we did The Queen Is Dead album, we started to use, it was a digital tape. So it was 24-track tape, and I think it had 24 tracks of digital. And we started using that because at the time, the bane of any kind of engineer's sound was tape hiss. Noise, you know. I mean, now people kind of love it. Well, they want analog and hiss and everything. But you know, back then, we didn't want it at all. We wanted to make the record sound, you know, immaculate and clean. We did not want tape hiss, and we did not want the drums to degenerate because the tape had gone over the head so many times, all that kind of thing. So I really kind of thought this is going to be excellent. You know, for digital tape recording, it's going to be no hiss, and it's going to be fantastic. And yeah, to a degree, it was okay. But then we came in one day and there was all these pops and bangs and cracking, you know, all kind of horrible noises happening all over this particular track. And it was so bad, you know, sometimes you could get around it by doing an edit, putting it back together again, because somehow that would get rid of it. I don't know why, it was weird. But anyway, it happened so much on one particular song that we had to re-record the song all over again. And obviously, no, that was not a great, you know, solution, really. And we went back to the tape manufacturer, they blamed the machine. We went back to the machine, they blamed the tape. You know, we just didn't get anywhere. So then I stayed well clear of that for a while and just stuck with recording back on tape. And then, so I stuck with tape for a while. And then the next big step, I guess, was kind of halfway through the 90s when hard disk recording was becoming, you know, the norm, I guess. Obviously, in between there, we had the DACs as well, because that was a new thing. So everyone had to go and buy themselves a DAC machine. I mean, when I think about it, it was quite, you know, as a young engineer, you'd spend quite a lot of money on equipment, you know. Anyway, the next big thing for me, Pro Tools started to show its head kind of mid-90s or thereabouts, but I didn't want to go near it. I just, the whole thing of, you know, as we do now, without even thinking about it, you know, staring at a screen all day with a mouse and doing things just filled me with dread. So the other thing that really came along that really took my ear, because it did sound really good too, because the converters were so great, was a thing called Radar. I bought one of the earliest models of that, 16 tracks of it, and that was made by Atari. And the 16 tracks I bought, I think, cost me about 24 grand, if I remember right. It was pretty expensive, you know. It was a pretty big chunk that I bought, big kind of box. It was quite, you know, a hefty system. But what I liked about it, it had a remote. It was just like the kind of tape remote, you know, 24 buttons that you armed, and you know, it had a tape button. It just felt very natural. It just felt like it was progressing naturally from where I was before, i.e., working with tape. But it gave me all these kind of, you know, editing potential, which was just fantastic. You know, so I could non-destructive editing, copying and pasting. It was just fantastic. Really, really simple system to get used to. And that's what I use when I work with Blur on the Blur album, the fifth album. And that's what, in fact, led to the drum loop on the front of song two. It was me experimenting with just recording some room mics and then just looping that little, that's the drum loop that you hear at the beginning of the song. So, you know, it was a great format because it allowed me just to record the band jamming, and then I could just take chunks and put them all together. And it did sound really good. So that was the kind of next technological step that I took. But then it got to about the early mid-2000s, and I realised that I was swimming against the tide. And, you know, Pro Tools was becoming the industry standard. And so I had to immerse myself in that. You know, it was difficult at first because I was so used to kind of like recording on a tape and putting that in a box or recording onto a cartridge and it was done, you know. Now there was folders and files and, you know, it was, I always remember saying to, you know, the assistant engineers helping me, like, you just get the session started up for me. I don't even know how to set up a session in the first place. You do that and then I'll take it from there. And to this day, I still don't really fully know all the real in-depth part of Pro Tools. I just know enough to do what I want to do, you know.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Let me show you what I'm recording on at the moment.
Okay, so what's that then?
It's a Zoom HD16 hard disk recording studio.
Oh, I remember those. Zoom, yeah, I had one of their effects units. Yeah.
It's really...
So where's that coming from?
I've had it probably for, I don't know, maybe 10 years now or something, but I bought a Mac off someone with Logic and I just couldn't get off the ground with it. And I sold it and bought this and I've made albums on this.
Have
I make my podcasts on this. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I just love it because it's just... It's tactile and it just...
Yes, absolutely. How many tracks have you got on it,
man? Well, it's 16. It's got 8 mono and then 4 stereo. So obviously you record... The idea is you record on a mono and bounce to the stereo to free up the mono tracks.
But that's great because it forces you to make decisions in the production of your track.
Yeah.
You know, whereas nowadays people just, you know, with infinite tracks, just, you know, chuck it all down and then, you know, come back to it and hopefully sort it out on the mix. But that's the wrong way of doing it. It's the same thing when I was working on 24 track. And, you know, but because you had these limitations, it made you commit to things and it made you think about what you were doing throughout the process. And I think that's really good. And I think that's something that you really kind of notice from the records that were done in pre-Pro Tools, that there was a commitment to sounds and things. And I actually think this work will sound better for it, you know.
Yeah, well, Peter Gabriel expounds that theory that the worst thing you can do for an artist is give them total freedom. If you tell them they can't do something, that's when they, like, sort of get creative, you know?
Yeah, totally.
I was thinking about sort of question I asked at the start about your role as a producer, and I think it's interesting that you mentioned Queen is Dead, where officially you're just not just an engineer, but you are the engineer on that record. By strange ways, you are a co-producer. And so I was curious as to whether your role actually changed between those records.
Not really. What what happened was I was actually getting a production royalty on The Queen Is Dead.
Right. Okay.
But Morrissey and Marr wanted to be credited because The Queen Is Dead, oh, sorry, Meet His Murder was credited as being produced by the Smiths. But most of the time it was Johnny, you know, and Morrissey would make a few comments about things, but mostly about his vocal. He didn't really worry about so much about how the track came together. And in fact, you know, obviously I was working hand in hand, you know, alongside Johnny on those recordings. So what happened was, I think it was just a gradual kind of recognition, as it were. And this, as I say, you know, this thing that the likes of Steve Lillywhite and Gil Norton and, you know, Hugh Padgham and all that, the engineering side of it was a very big part of it. Because what would happen would be the drummer would go in there and they want you to get a sound. They want you to get a sound that's going to determine the sound of that record. You know, it's a bit like a film director. You know, I mean, I often say to this to people, they go, oh, is a film producer the same as a record producer? And I go, no, a film producer, as you mentioned, facilitates. He gets the director, he gets the cameraman, he gets the, you know, he gets the screenwriters to sharpen the script. And then they get a director in there to work with the actors to get the creativity, you know, get it on celluloid or on film. Record producers are very much like film directors. We get in there amongst the artists or the artists, and we help them get the performance out of them and get it down on tape or hard drive now. So that's the way I see it. But at the same time, because of what I mentioned, my inspiration, a lot of those people that I was inspired by were the engineers, because they would get a sound for the artist. You know, and they would say to the artist, say, well, have you thought about, you know, doing this to your vocal or do this to your drum sound and we can get it, you know. So these kind of things, these sonic designs, sonic changes were, as far as I was concerned, production. And obviously, you know, a band sometimes might have been playing a song for a while in the live set and it's perfect. It doesn't need to be honed anymore arrangement-wise. That is it. But what they do need is someone to get it sonically sounding correct. So that is a really big part of it, you know. So as opposed to someone perhaps that's working with, I don't know, Tom Jones or Shirley Bassey, who has to get an arrangement in and all that, it's a very different vibe, you know? So that's the way I looked at it, you know? And so for me, as I was able to get my influence on the sound of the Smiths and little ideas like false fade-ins and kind of, you know, and sometimes false fade-outs, you know, you get something kind of breaking down and then there's a little thing comes back in again. All the little things you do as an engineer to make it interesting, you know, would be suggested and you'd work upon that. And so I guess most probably that was a nice gradual, you know, ladder for me to climb. And you're quite correct, you know, it was engineer, but with a production royalty, and then co-producer. So it was a nice kind of curve, you know, going up.
When Lloyd Cole came on the show, he mentioned about being, he said he was briefly friends with Morrissey. And because I'd asked him about persona, you know, and how much of Lloyd Cole was persona and how much was him and the sort of divisions between that. And he mentioned that when he was friends with Morrissey, he felt that Morrissey had got so used to just being the character of Morrissey almost that he sort of didn't take a break from it. And I wondered if that was your experience. Did Morrissey become increasingly kind of idiosyncratic through the years you worked with him, or did you just find him consistent from day one? And
pretty consistent, to be honest with you. I mean, they do say there's a thin line between genius and madness, yeah. You know. In some ways, and you know, there'll be sometimes when you think, what the hell is he on? But then there'll be other moments when, I mean, the sheer genius of the lyric and then the performance of it as well would be, you know, breathtaking. So I just knew that I was in the presence of someone that was A, very different, B, very talented. And I just wanted to make sure that I didn't block his performance or do anything that upset him. Because Morrissey's one of those people, if something isn't right, you know, he's off, he's gone. So I didn't want to be, you know, and that's what happened to me later on. You know, something was a friction and something happened. But, you know, that's it. I just wanted to make sure that this fantastic new type of lead singer in a band that was so, you know, so fantastic. I just didn't want to get in the way. I just want to make sure that I really did help get the best out of him. But I would also play little tricks, though. I mean, Morrissey's known for not wanting to do too many vocal takes, especially in the early days, you know, working with the Smiths. And I would kind of, you know, do, even when I was just setting up everything, I would do a recording while he was warming up. And then I'd make up that something wasn't quite right with the mic, or there was a, can I have another run through, please? You know, I mean, you got to be careful. You don't want to push him. But I would try and make sure that I got a few performances out of him before he went, okay, I've had enough now, you know, he's done. And then I could then compile the best of the performance. And even then it was great. He would trust me to do, you know, do the comp as it were.
Yeah.
And then come in and listen to it, you know, and that was it. So I would always kind of work pretty hard on making sure I had, you know, having said that, 3 or 4 takes normally with him, you had everything you need.
Yeah.
To be honest, it was great. But if you had his way, you would have done 1 or 2 and gone. You know, just give you those extra 2 takes to kind of have a little bit more options.
It's interesting because you had a long relationship with the Smiths and then a long relationship with Blur. And in some ways, they're very, in some ways, aesthetically similar in the, you know, like Blur having like a consistent logo and the attention to the aesthetics and I guess the sort of influence on British culture. But they seem like such different bands, and particularly the difference between Marr and Coxon. Both phenomenal guitarists, but Marr, you kind of feel like there's not a single note out of place and everything is clear and perfect. Was it a challenge trying to leave things imperfect when working with Blur? Because there's a chaos, even on record, there's a chaos and a scuzziness to it that like you can't take away. Was it a challenge to know where the line was between making this a record that is going to be palatable and potentially a single, but leaving Coxon's kind of sonic identity intact?
Not at all. It really? Felt very natural. I felt as soon as I worked with Blur, I felt it was the first band I'd worked with post the Smiths where I had the same kind of sense of real excitement. There's something really special here. There's a real chemistry here as well between the band. A, Damon is very driven, same as Morrissey. B, Graham is a genius guitar player, same as Johnny. Alex was a fantastic bass player, same as Andy Rourke, you know, and Dave and Mike were just solid drummers. You know, and there was a chemistry. When you saw them as 4 people in a photo, they looked right. They looked like a band. That's what the Smiths looked like as well, you know. Even though the camera might focus more on Morrissey particularly or Johnny as well, but they still, the Smiths always looked like a proper band. Yeah. And so this is what Blur had too. And, you know, that's important, you know. It's not all just how they sound, it's how they project themselves visually as well. And I thought this is a really great band and the quality of the writing was incredible. Yes, you're right in the sense that although Graham actually was a huge Johnny Marr fan, his actual way of playing was very, as you say, rugged and edgy against what Johnny would do. But I found that really quite exciting. And there's a way that Graham that plays that he really developed over the years, using his pedals as well as, you know, his technique with his hands, that really was incredible too. I think tracks like Oily Water and there's many other tracks too that, you know, it's the way he steps on and off. It was very creative. And I've actually made more records of Graham Coxon than anyone else in my career, you know, the Blur records and solo material. I never tire of working with him. And just to be in a room with him and watch his fingers go up and down, you know, he's a very, very technical guitar player. Amazing. It's the feel thing. You know, people can go, oh, can you get me a Graham Coxon sound, you know, with the same amp and the same guitar. I say, it won't sound like Graham Coxon because it's how he plays, it's how he hits the strings, it's how he dampens the strings, it's how he pulls the strings. It's quite grotesque sometimes. He deliberately wants to be grotesque, but that's what, you know, makes him sound like he sounds. And I think it's wonderful.
I find it quite sad when I, with Blur though, when you sort of take a deeper dive into him, it seems like they were so unhappy throughout the 90s, particularly Graham. There just seemed to be obviously a lot of alcohol abuse, etc. And it just seems like everything was so fraught and about to collapse all the time. Is that a very distorted picture from your point of view?
I think the alcohol thing didn't help. I mean, it was, you know, this band worked hard. I mean, don't forget, we had a breakthrough with obviously She's So High, which was before I got involved. But then the first thing I did with them was There's No Other Way, which was a big hit for them, you know. And they thought, okay, here we go, jolly, it's all going to go great. And then they had a really rough ride for a year and a half. You know, they did a horrible, demoralising tour of America.
Yeah.
Their manager at the time allegedly disappeared with a lot of money. That was, and the band were pretty much bankrupt by the time they came back from their tour. It'd been rough, you know. These young guys are only in their early 20s and they've been put through the mill. And then, you know, things started to build up again after Modern Life is Rubbish, and then Punk Life just went bang, went global. And then suddenly everyone wanted a piece of them. And not everyone can deal with that, you know, especially, I don't think Graham dealt with it very well. Alex took to it like a duck to water, but you're right. I mean, it caused a lot of problems. And then there was this constant touring. I mean, the band didn't stop. They were either in the studio or they were on the road, very much like the Smiths. Exactly. I thought there was a lot of parallels, you know, that were either touring, writing, recording. It was just nonstop, like hamsters in a wheel, you know, it really was. And it got to me, and it broke the band up nearly. And in fact, when we did the fifth album, the Blur album, before we went in and started the record, they were very much on the verge of breaking up. You know, I mean, Graham just did not want to be in the same room as Alex, because Alex was living at large doing his Soho thing, and Graham just wanted to kind of drink himself silly in the pubs of Camden and stuff. There was a real mismatch going on somewhere. And in fact, Damon sent me to go and to talk with Graham, to try and talk him round to the idea of starting the session, you know, because at the time he didn't want to start the recording at all. So it was touch and go for a while, you know, it really was. And you're right, there was a lot of anger, I think. I think, you know, most probably Graham felt a little bit as if, you know, the attention to Blur was too much on Damon, perhaps. So a slight kind of bit of jealousy there, perhaps, about, not so much about the attention, but more who gets the say in what they do. You know, kind of, I mean, obviously Damon is the major writer, but Graham's very particular about what he does to the song ideas that Damon brings forward to turn it into what we know as, you know, Blur. So, yeah, there was a lot, it was dark for a while. But I think, you know, they've got through that. And now they're grown men, you know, and they'll have their times when they're happy to be together. And there's times, obviously, when they don't want to be in each other's company, you know.
It's fascinating seeing sort of a making of a magic whip, which was lovely. They got you back for that. It seems like Graham is like a different person now. He's almost unrecognisable and just seems so like at peace. And I wondered if it was difficult because that album was kind of made kind of behind Damon's back. You had these sessions that he'd made in Hong Kong for 5 days, which weren't finished. And so then Graham kind of gets you in and gets Alex and Dave kind of secretly together sometimes. So you're making this album, but you don't actually know if it's ever going to come out. Was that frustrating?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, what happened there was, I mean, as you say, I think Graham, as you rightly just said, softened a little bit in his attitude and grew up a bit, you know, and I think he realised, he cherished how much Blur meant to him. And so when they did this, you know, they did the reunion shows, Glastonbury and that kind of thing. They quite enjoyed, I think Graham enjoyed it. And at this point, he managed to kind of controlling his drinking and such, and he was in a better place. Anyway, spring forward to, yes, what happened with the Magic Whip. So they were on tour, they're in the Far East, and they realised that they had a gap because one gig had been pulled, and they had a gap, and they thought, there's no point going home, we might as well stay out here and do this kind of jam session. So what would happen, Damon is always writing all the time. He tends to write on GarageBand on an iPad. That's his format that he works with. So he basically got the engineer, Steve Sedgwick, to copy some of the songs that he thought might be suitable from the GarageBand iPad onto Pro Tools. And the band just jammed on top of some song ideas. They were taken back to the UK, and then Damon kind of worked with them for a little bit and kind of lost interest, you know, in kind of gravitated back towards Gorillaz or something. One of these, he's got so many different projects he's working on. But he basically said, I'm not feeling it, and he left it. So it sat in the can for about 18 months or so. Now, Graham, at this point, was really keen to try and see if something could be done with these recordings. So he went to Damon with the idea, said, you know, do you mind if I take them and see if we can do something? And Damon said, yeah. So who are you going to do it with? Graham, apparently, I want to see what I can do with Stephen. And Damon said, well, great. Because at this point, Damon was, you know, he was off on another project he did. So, Graham, I always remember getting a phone call from Graham and said, look, we've got these recordings. We don't know what we've got. Can you ever listen to them, you know, and let us know what you think? So I said, look, what I don't want to do is sit there listening to it with you over my shoulder, kind of like, I want to be completely in the clear, vanilla kind of state, as it were, listening to them as if they were just demos that anyone else had given to me. And then I want to be able to, if I can, do a little bit of editing on them and try and get some shape. Because from what I could gather, you know, there'll be all these tracks were running like 7 minutes plus, you know, I mean, or even more, you know, that just like time sessions on top of song ideas. Some have been worked in a little bit more. Damon had done a couple of tracks where he'd done a bit more on them and got them into a more song shape. But some were just a bit kind of rambling. So I went through all the files, picked out the best kind of 12 to 13, because I think one was about 17 or 18, perhaps, and did a bit of work on them. I always remember kind of putting a bit more shape into Get Out. And I always remember also Lonesome Street. When I first played it, I was playing it at the wrong sample rate. So I was playing it at a faster speed. And then I realised that the other recordings were at the other sample rate. So I listened back to it at the lower sample rate and dragged. It was really slow. I said to Graham, so I've done what I can with Lonesome Street, I said, but I'm playing it at the wrong sample rate because I think it needs to be at this tempo. And he agreed. So we had to do everything again on Lonesome Street. But, you know, like, and I had to vary speed the bits that Damon had done that I couldn't go back to him. But all the guitars we did again. And I'd sped up the drums and then got Dave back in to do the drums proper. So we got that back up to speed, or up to the right tempo, as it were. And bit by bit, we just worked on it. I got Alex back in to do some bass on some songs. Some of the bass recordings were fine from Hong Kong, but some needed to be done again properly. Yeah. But all the time we're doing this, we're still not sure that whether Damon's going to come on board. You know, we were really kind of at this point, like, we've got to make this as good as we possibly can so that when we present it to Damon, he will say, yeah, okay, I'm up for it. So that's after I'd done my week on my own, putting some shape and stuff. Then I did a week or two with Graham. Then I got Dave and Alex in to do some bits and pieces again. And then kind of formulated some rough mixes of all those recordings. Took them to Damon with Graham. And I remember sitting there with Graham and we're kind of like, really kind of like thinking, okay, it's like taking it to an A&R man, you know, hoping to get signed.
Yeah.
And Damon puts it on, starts listening to it, and I can see him kind of beginning to really get. And he was like, great, love it. Let's do it. And then he said, shall I take the tapes now and finish it off? I said, no. I said, I've taken it this far. I want to be there and work with you on your vocals now and produce it through to the end. And he sat, he looked at me for a minute and went, okay, that sounds great. Yeah, all right, let's do that then. So he said, I can work with you in January. This was like late November or something because he was still busy doing something else. So I said, great. And at this point, I hadn't worked with Damon since 1996. I'd worked with Graham, but I'd been doing the Graham solo stuff. So I wasn't really sure how we would, you know, how we'd click.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was a little bit nervous because, you know, he's quite a forthright character, is our Damon. And he doesn't, you know, suffer fools gladly. You know, he's quite determined and driven and everything. I thought, oh, I'm just wondering if I'll better get my tuppence worth in. But anyway, got in the studio with him, and we just picked up where we left off. It was fantastic. Lovely mutual respect between the two of us. Helped him kind of like, you know, hone his vocal performances a bit more. And it was wonderful. We had a wonderful session. In 2 weeks, we had done all his vocals and his keyboard touches, you know, that he puts on. And went ahead and mixed it with Steve Sedgwick. And it was great. It was just such a wonderful record because it came out of nowhere, really. It could have just ended up staying in the can. Yet we managed to kind of finish it off.
Talking of unusual kind of coders to careers, how was it making the final Cranberries record? Was it a harrowing experience? I mean, it's hard. I guess it's hard to, you can't be sad all the time. You know, so it's like, even when dealing with a situation that sensitive, there must have been moments of levity where you were happy to be together.
Yeah, it was difficult in the sense that obviously the situation in which, you know, Dolores passed away was quite tragic, so that hurt. But again, when the guy sent me some demos, he said, look, these are the things we were working on. There were some demos that she had done with session musicians in the United States because, you know, she lived out there. And there were some demos that were very, very rough demos that she'd done it in her apartment in New York. I think Noel was sending her stuff on Logic, and she had Logic, and she would record vocals and so on. So there were some bits and pieces. And again, it was a very, very similar situation to the Blur thing in the sense they just sent me everything that had been done. And some songs were worth finishing. Some songs were like, it's scraping the barrel. And this is one thing I did not want to be accused of, because when someone's passed away and you're making a record in those circumstances, you don't want to be seen as someone that's kind of, you know, scraping the barrel to, you know, and trying to capitalize on someone's passing. So if we made this vow between us, we'll give it a go, but if we don't think it meets the standard, we're going to drop it, okay? And at this point, the band were funding this themselves. There was no pressure from a record company. It was just purely they wanted to try and come up with one more record, a fitting kind of swan song, as it were, to the band's career. So this is the kind of record that could not have been done back in the day before the days of Pro Tools, you know? It really did need that kind of computer manipulation, taking things and moving things around. And I would hunt for other vocal takes in the background and see if I could get some other lyrics. And, you know, because sometimes she would do different versions of things because she would be writing or honing the lyric a bit as she was doing her demos. So sometimes the vocals were really badly recorded. And if they were done that way, then when it came to mixing them, I would treat them in the sense I'd make them sound a little bit radiofied, you know what I mean? Rather than try and make them sound lush, and try and do a slightly thinner, kind of scratchier vocal sound to give them a kind of a sense of place, yeah. You know, and sonically. After I'd done that initial work of putting in some shape to some of the real rough demos, and after I'd listened through to the demos she'd done with the American session musicians, again, with those sessions she'd done with the session musicians, I'd go, well, I would sometimes change the arrangements a little bit, but then take off everything and get the guys to do what they would play. I say to them, try not to listen too much to what those musicians have done. These are the chords. You know, that's the kind of groove it is, but you just do your thing. So I would literally just play perhaps a rough guide guitar from those sessions and the click track and her vocal, and the boys would just go in and play to it like they would have done in the old days, you know, with her singing in the room. And that was great, but it was emotional. The very first day, I always remember when we set Fergal and Mike and Noel up in the studio, and then we started working on a song that, you know, they put on their headphones and there was a click track and then her voice came in. I think that the guys found it quite emotional because it was them working to her vocal, but she wasn't there anymore. That kind of hit them a little bit, I think. And then the other emotional part was the last day of the recording. We did the whole backing tracks with the three lads. I had them for 2 weeks in London. I did some more work with Noel, finishing off guitars afterwards, but I always remember the last day of the tracking kind of session, and the record was taking really good shape. I remember Fergal doing his drums to the last song that was needed drums and done, and Mike playing bass, because I always did the bass and drums together. They do lock into each other very well when they play together. And you know, in the past when they made a record, you know, they'll go, "Oh great, we can't wait to go out and play this live now and perform these new songs." And it suddenly hit them that they would never play these songs. You know, that was it. That would be the last time they played that song, perhaps, you know, that was it. And I remember them being a little bit upset at the end of that session that day.
And I guess it's hard not to sort of be reading stuff into the lyrics as well. And like the closing song in the end, particularly, feels like such a kind of a bleak end. It doesn't, it doesn't feel like a happy ending, does it?
She wasn't in a great place, let's face it, she wasn't. I mean, again, she had her drink problems and so on. She wasn't in a great place. She divorced her husband or was in the process of divorcing her husband. You know, things weren't great for her. And when I heard that song in the end, I said, that's got to be the last track on the record. Because you know, at the time, it was just demos given to me. I said, and I think, you know, that should be what we call the album too, because it is the end, you know. So that was always kind of earmarked as being, that's the end of the album. And help, you know, and then we worked out how we were going to start it, obviously with a bit more of an upbeat rock song. But I always knew I wanted in the end to be at the very end. And it's, you know, it's a fantastic performance. Again, very roughly recorded that vocal, but did what I could with it. That little kind of Gaelic refrain, that high vocal thing she did once in the song, I thought I'm going to use that as a hook because it was such a fantastic little line. And moved that around, you know, in Pro Tools so I could get it where I wanted it to be. And then got John Metcalf, who's the string arranger that I normally use to, or always use, I guess, really, to do the string arrangement to it as well. So I was really pleased with the way that record came together. And you know, I did really feel that we'd done something that was a great, it was correct. It wasn't, as I referred to earlier, scraping the barrel. You know, it did hit a standard that was required that made it worthwhile. I was very proud of it.
To finish, can I just can I ask you about three songs, and you can tell me anything you want about them that might be of interest? Is that all right? I'm just gonna pick three that I really like.
And okay, yeah, go ahead.
Any memories or anything you think is interesting? So I'll go chronologically. So the Smiths, I Know It's Over.
Recorded at Jacob's Studios. The initial recording for The Queen Is Dead was kind of piecemeal. We'd done a kind of couple of sessions. Well, A, they'd done The Boy with the Thorn Inside in the 8-track in Manchester. Then we had done Big Mouth Strikes Again in Rack Studios, and Some Girls Are Bigger Than Others, I think, might have done there too. And then we finally did the proper session, which was at Jacob's, which was a residential studio. And that's when we kind of really got into the recording for the main part of the album. You know, that kind of, that song, it just had a lovely kind of languid feel to it. I think we tried to put a trumpet or something on it at one time, because it had a kind of slightly jazzy feel to it, you know.
Yeah.
But I can't remember now too much about that. But I just remember it being a great vocal performance. And what I love about it is the space in that track. It just hangs in the air, you know. But again, one of those things that you do the run through with Mike, Andy, and Johnny, get that first initial pass, and then you get Morrissey's vocal on it as quickly as you can, because that is the framework that you can hang everything else off of, you know?
Yeah.
That's really about the crux of it, really. Yeah.
Do you remember him doing the vocal for it? Is it like a memory?
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, as I alluded to earlier on, get 3 or 4 takes and that's it, you've got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I'll just comp it, try and get the best. He might then go in and do some little kind of high warbling, kind of some BVs or something. But generally, you got what you needed pretty quickly. And then that gave Johnny the framework to see where he needed to kind of put the extra colours.
Yeah, it's a stunning moment. And it reminds me, it might be I Still Do on the first Cranberries album. That sounds a lot like I Know It's Over, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that kind of hanging there. It's that kind of ethereal kind of feeling, you know? I always say space is just as important as where the notes are.
Yeah.
Really is important.
All right, second song then. Obvious one, but Linger by the Cranberries. Because it is... The trouble with the Cranberries is because her accent is so distinct. It's easy to... I think as soon as you... If you mention Linger to someone, they're going to start... They're going to sing a bit of it in a stupid voice.
Linger.
And it's like, and it's so annoying because it's both, it's both the element that made people sit up and take notice, but it's also easy to parody. And I think it's meant that song gets a bit overlooked at just how stunning and perfect it is. It is jaw-droppingly perfect.
It strikes me, you know, it's really weird because I always remember when I got first sent a cassette from Island Records of the demos of Cranberries had for their first album. And they approached me and said, we'd like you to work with this band, can you ever listen? So I had to listen through, and there was, on this cassette were Dreams and Linger and some other songs, I can't remember now. And I said, yeah, can I like these, I particularly want to do Dreams and Linger. And they went, oh no, we don't want you to do Linger yet, we just want to see whether it's going to work. So I was sent over to Dublin and I did Dreams and I did some other tracks with them. And took those back, and the record company went, yeah, great, loving it. You can now go back in and do the proper session. So I went back in and we did Linger on that session. Now, what always struck me was thinking back, if I brought a song to you now, a slow kind of love type song, and said, and the drummer's going to be doing a paradiddle snare thing all the way through it, you go, what are you thinking? I mean, it's the most weirdest thing. This kind of constant snare rattling kind of thing going through the
song. A shuffle, yeah.
Yeah, it's just kind of, but it seemed to work. But what we couldn't quite get, it's one of those songs that it has this kind of weird intro that then kind of has a completely different feel to the main part of the song. So it has to be this kind of crossfade thing where it happens. And then you've got this constant snare thing going on, but at the same, which is taking up a lot of space in the song. But at the same time, you've got to try and create this sense of coolness and space. And we couldn't quite work out what we wanted to do with the bass drum. We didn't know whether we wanted to kind of dum 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 be pushed or dum dum dum. It was kind of, and we played around with it quite a bit, and also the tempo, because it's one of those songs, if you play it too fast it feels like it's tripping over itself, and if you play it too slow it feels like the most laborious slow grinding thing you could ever think of. It really, it was trying to get that tempo dead right so it felt, you know, write for the, you know, for the recording, was it was one of those things that was a bit of a, I do remember getting Mikey back in and saying, I'm not sure about the bass drum pattern. I want to change the bass drum again. So what we did was, I think we recorded this shuffle and then didn't do the bass drum, just did that all the way through to a kind of click, and then got the bass drum and the bass to kind of play. You know, I got further than Mike to kind of, so we could experiment with it because we weren't totally sold on how we were going to play it. So we went around the houses a little bit on it, but it was worth it because it actually worked out really well in the end. But I still find it strange that there's a song like that and it's got a constant snare pattern going through it. But it just feels natural, doesn't it?
It's amazing.
But now I look back at it and I'm thinking, nowadays if someone brought me a song like that, I'd go, tell you what, take the snare out. It's too much, you know? It's just weird.
It's spine tingling, mate. It's amazing. All right, finally then, This Is a Low by Blur.
Yeah, well, that's one that nearly didn't make it.
Really?
Only because Damon didn't write the lyrics for it until the very end. It was very unusual because normally when we work on a song, Damon would do a guide vocal on it pretty quickly, again, so we could see where we were with it. But this one, he wasn't singing on it. It was just like, you know, it was just, he had a rough idea of the melody. We recorded pretty much everything for Part Life album. This song is sitting there and it still hasn't got a lyric on it. And it's kind of, well, is it going to make the record? And I always remember sitting there there was a kind of canteen area at Maison Rouge Studios where we were recording and kind of talking with Damon and Graham and Alex and saying, you know, to Damon, come on, this is a really good backing track. Can we get a vocal on it? Because if we can, we can mix this, because we were literally mixing all the tracks and so that we can get it on the record. Anyway, as you might have heard the story, I think he received a present from Alex that was wrapped in paper that was, I think, it gave all the kind of the naval districts around the UK, you know.
Oh, okay.
And that inspired him, you know, Dogger Bank and all these other kind of quite strange names that were given to the naval kind of areas, fishing areas around the UK. And I think it triggered something in his mind, and he wrote the lyric. And I always remember it was the last day, we were pretty much in the last day of mixing at Maison Rouge. And he came in that morning, he picked up my semi-acoustic guitar that was in the room, because he used to like singing with the guitar in front of him, because sometimes you'd strum along. Sometimes it was a pain because you'd pick up the guitar as well, you know. It's like, don't, can you not do that when you're doing it? But he would just like to strum to himself in between takes. Anyway, he did the vocal. He then had to go off, because I think he had a hernia or something, he had to go off and had an operation that afternoon. So he did his vocal in the morning, disappeared. I sat there with John Smith, the engineer, comped the vocal, mixed it straight away. I always remember getting a phone call from Damon about 6-7 o'clock later on that evening. Obviously, he'd just come out of being put under for the operation. Kind of slightly bleary, asking how it'd gone. Is it all done? Is it fine? I said, yeah, it's great. It's going to sound like, no, it's fine. It's in the can. It's done. And that was it, really. So it was literally the last thing we did on Part Life album. It was the getting the vocal and then mixing it all in the same day.
Wow. It's the height of emotional intensity, isn't it? And as a live song as well. Mate, I hope I haven't taken too much of your time. I've loved this.
That's fine. Great. I hope you let me know when you're broadcasting it. I'd like to tune in. I'm sorry if I rambled on a little bit, but that's the...
Don't apologise, mate. It's been fantastic. Thank you so much, mate. I've loved it.
Pleasure. Nice one.
Look after yourself, all right?
All right, then. Cheers, then.
Take care, mate. Bye. While you're here, if you're new to the show, thanks for listening. If you've listened before, thanks for coming back. Very quickly, if you want to help, please subscribe to the show so you don't miss an episode. And leaving a review with your podcast provider, whoever it is, would be really appreciated. Back to the show. Savile Row is a street in London synonymous with bespoke tailoring and has been for, well, it's almost safe to say centuries now. A key development in the history of the area was the opening of Henry Paul & Co. on the street in 1846, creating an entrance from the back of a premises on the parallel Old Burlington Street. The company was actually founded in 1806. Famous clients have included assorted kings and emperors, Winston Churchill, Irving Berlin, Bram Stoker, Charles Dickens. The company is credited with the invention of the dinner suit, or tuxedo for our transatlantic listeners.
There was a point by the early 1900s when the company employed 300 tailors and 14 cutters. There was a period of about 20 years where, due to redevelopments, the company moved off of the street. But today, Henry Paul stands at number 15 Savile Row. The influence of Savile Row on fashion and pop culture is immense. My good friend Tom Pendry is one of the directors of Henry Paul & Co. and I thought it would be great to talk to him for the show and get a sense of where the creativity lies in the industry. Thanks for coming on the show.
Don't you layer that afterwards?
Layer what afterwards?
Well, hi, how are you? And all of this sort of thing.
No, it's a conversation.
Oh, okay, all right. We'll just chat. Lovely.
I do edit, so I can do things, but, you know, I'm not going to, like, record a hello and welcome to a show later.
You're going to chop up what I say, like cassette boy or something, and mash it all up and... Sorry, I'm holding you up. Anyway, you crack on.
So you are on the board of directors at Henry Paul & Co. How old is the company?
The company started in 1806, over 200 years.
Really? That's older than I thought, actually.
They're considered the founders of Savile Row as a location for gentlemen's clothing. And they opened there... in the mid-1800s, and it was the back door at the time. The front door was on Old Burlington Street, and Savile Row was the rear of the building. And in time, they made that the front of the building. So at the time, Savile Row was a street built on an old estate, but it was predominantly filled with doctors. So when a tailor opened on Savile Row, it was seen as slightly more down market. This is a tradesman.
Huh.
And so all the doctors started moving, and they ended up where people recognised their trade, in Harley Street. And because of the popularity of Henry Paul, it attracted other tailoring houses to that area. A bit like what you might find in Berwick Street with record shops and things like this.
Which is what I was going to say, the idea of a geographic location meaning something. Like, I was thinking, you know, Denmark Street of guitars, or Berwick Street used to think of record shops, not so much anymore. And so it's kind of, in this day and age, you're kind of dependent on some kind of sort of reverence existing for that location still. Is that hard to maintain in, like, the internet age?
More so because the area, that part of Mayfair, has become an incredibly wealthy part of London. And business rents and rates have increased massively. You have companies that operate in that part of London, like art dealers and fancy offices that can pay huge rents. The tailors on Savile Row have grouped together to try and preserve a recognition of the area as a heritage site, in a way. There's an organisation of bespoke tailors that do have a voice with the landlords. And to be fair, the landlords in that area do want to preserve the heritage and the history of the area, and do provide a bit of favourable recognition. So it is a challenge, and who's to say that in the future that may change? The area shift. The internet shopping age has come along recently, but over 200 years of trading, lots of different shopping methods have come along. In the 1960s, when ready-to-wear suits became a lot more popular and freely available, bespoke tailoring, of course, declined a little bit in popularity. And of course, in the internet age, you have characters, incredibly influential businessmen. Take Mark Zuckerberg, for example, who's doing board meetings in a T-shirt and jeans. We've been through that sort of thing. And of course, I'm seeing a slight shift in the other direction. People want to look smart again, depending on which part of the world you are and what sort of image you want to portray. People do want to have an edge in any particular way they possibly can. And if your suit is cut in a certain way, it might give you a slight edge. It's also a nice thing. It's become what we do is very much considered a luxury good now. It's a luxury clothing. It's a luxury process. You cannot buy a bespoke suit on the internet, however much they like to label it as such. The word bespoke has got a bit of an interesting connotation in terms of it meaning, particularly if you go and choose a bit of fabric to make an item of clothing for, that bit of cloth would be spoken for, hence bespoke. And then you have to go through the process of that being crafted by hand for you. It's a very individual thing. It would be very, very difficult to control the use of the word bespoke. Forget it. But there are plans to try and control the use of the phrase Savile Row in connection with clothing. In the same way that you cannot produce champagne out of the Champagne region,
yeah,
it would be a sparkling white wine anywhere else. It would be nice that the phrase Savile Row meant the same thing as far as clothing was concerned.
What do you actually do? Do you define yourself as a cutter? Is that still the case?
You're absolutely right. My job title is cutter. That is as in a pattern cutter. It's a craft. I measure a gentleman, a series of measurements. I transfer those measurements to a piece of card, thick brown paper card, on my board, and I create a two-dimensional card pattern using chalk, tailor's chalk, and occasional sort of shaped rulers, tailor's square. I cut that, and then I transfer that paper pattern onto a piece of fabric. I work out how much fabric the gentleman needs, order an economically prudent amount of fabric, and then chalk around the paper pattern on the fabric and cut out the fabric. I then bundle that up with all the necessary trimmings, the canvas, the buttons, any funny threads you might need, the pocketing material, bundle it all up, and that's where my initial purpose is fulfilled. I then give that bundle to a tailor in our basement workshops. They make up a skeleton fitting, a sort of loosely tacked together suit that's not finished with the basics. I then see the customer for a fitting, put that on, have a look at it, poke it around, pull it, rip it apart, pin it back together a bit, say thank you very much. The customer leaves. I rip all that apart, press it all flat, change my paper pattern, any necessary adjustments. I might have made something too short, too long, too skinny, too fat, you know. And then transfer all those changes to the fabric and give it back to a tailor who will make it up to the next stage, more advanced stage. Repeat that process by seeing the customer again a couple more times until it's ready to actually finish. And then hopefully the customer can walk away with it. So we like to see a customer about three times. Process takes about 8 to 10 weeks. And that's then where my role ends. If they come back in a couple of years and they've lost a load of weight, then I'll see them and make a few adjustments. But that's essentially what I do. I remember going home after working for a couple of years and seeing my mother, and she'd ask, what did you do at work today? And I'd been adjusting paper patterns, and it involves chopping bits of card up with my shears, tailoring shears, and maybe sticking another bit of card on in another place. I thought about it a bit. Well, essentially today I've been cutting and sticking. She was like, well, not much has changed since primary school, has it, Tom? So that's essentially what I do. I hope that makes sense. It's rudimentary, yeah, sort of craft.
So do you consider it to be a creative job?
Interesting question. I consider it to be a craft, that's what it is.
Yeah.
A lot of people who are pattern cutting and making clothing call themselves designers. And it's sometimes an easier way to describe what I do, but I don't think what I do is design. I think it's more engineering. It's engineering for the body. It's like being an architect for a body instead of a building for an item of clothing. there is a creative element to it, because you may not know, I think the collective noun for a group of tailors is a disguisery.
Huh.
So there's a creative aspect in that you occasionally, a lot of what you do when you're cutting a pattern, when you're designing a suit, it may be a boring grey business suit, but you may have a gentleman that doesn't want to look like how his body makes him look. So we would have to create or manufacture a silhouette for his body and make it look natural, make it look aesthetically pleasing, proportionate, but it may not resemble his actual figure. So there's an illusion that you need to create, and that is a creative process. You need to design then a structure that will change his appearance in a way that doesn't stand out. If you made a suit that fitted some people's bodies, it would look like their bodies, and that in my case, that wouldn't be a great thing. So you do have a creative side to that. I liken it more to architecture. You do need to work around various problems. Some people have had accidents. Some people, none of us are symmetrical, for example. We have higher shoulder one side or a lower hip one side, different stances. It's been interesting traveling for work in different cultures. You have noticeably different postures, for example, a slightly more swayed figure in some countries as a rule than in others. So that's interesting as well. When my job does get truly creative is when somebody comes in with a project and an idea and a design, something that's not just a business suit. They want to maybe recreate a heritage garment, a historical piece. They may want to think, they may have seen something in a magazine and want to design something using that as a basis. So occasionally I'll be with a customer that may be doing a few sketches, talking about the design, the style, what would work best for their figure. Do you want lapels this wide? Do you want a single-breasted look, a double-breasted look? What sort of pattern would you like on the fabric? Looking at fabrics, different fabrics, does this work with your skin tone, your complexion, your size? And then marrying that to perhaps an event. And that's a really purely creative design process, often collaborative. You can do that with a customer. And that's incredibly fun. I take great delight in just making something fit someone. My job is to make a garment fit. They could come in with a very specific design. I want this garment. I want to look like that. My job is to make it fit them. They may want lapels flying off their shoulders or something that I consider too long or too short or looks a bit, you know, a bit out of my regular box. But I don't care. You can design whatever you want. My job is really to make that fit your body. My creative side of it is making that look good, is translating your vision sometimes to your body. Yeah, it's sometimes a challenge.
Yeah,
as you can imagine.
I remember you gave me a tour of the shop once and the basement workshops, etc. And I have a memory of you telling me, I think it was on that occasion, that when certain staff eventually retire, they have skills which are just going to be lost. And I wondered how much the craft has changed in the past 100 years. Does technology affect what you do in any way, or is there just a purist approach where what we do does not change?
I think it's very difficult to recreate what somebody's hands do. You can improve shears, you can improve, look at scissors, they're much better than they were 300 years ago in some cases, not in all. Weaving technology has massively improved. So if you go back a few decades, people were wearing heavier fabrics, obviously not such good heating, central heating in buildings, thicker wall suitings. But with the weaving technology they have now, they are weaving such fine, beautiful, thin fabrics, beautiful wool mixes and cashmere blends. that you could not have made 100 years ago. The technology just wasn't there. So they're making fabric that if you made in a method that you would have made clothing in 200 years ago, you'd destroy the fabric. So you have to have a finer touch almost. Bespoke tailors have almost had to improve their finesse to match the technology. Because you can get incredibly clean garments made from factory line production. So why not buy something that looks cleaner from there, that's cheaper than having it made by hand? So you'd have, as craftsmen, you do have to raise your standards to match what people can get elsewhere, of course. So I'd say tailoring is almost improved because the technology's improved. Yes, tailors use machines. So your long stitches down the side of your trousers and your sleeves, yeah, it's all done by machines. Whereas many years ago, that would have been done by hand, which is a laborious, time-consuming exercise that doesn't involve too much skill, really. So you'd have sweatshops where people would do that all day, every day. A machine, obviously, is a much more efficient way of doing that. So we do want to be efficient. With regard to the skills being lost, Savile Row tailors have a rich history of training. So we like to preserve the skills, pass them on to the next generation. And that's how I was taught. Very fortunate to learn from gentlemen with over 50 years of tailoring experience, you know, incredibly experienced gentlemen, and very kind and patient, and also not too precious about their knowledge. There are some in the trade, perhaps, who are more precious about their skills, and because historically you wouldn't want to share skills that you had in case somebody took your job. Whereas now there's not such a supply of people with the skills, people are more willing to perhaps share it. So there's always been a system of master and apprentice transfer of skills. That's what I benefited from. And that's another, talking about creativity, having to transfer your creative skill to someone else is a challenge because people are creative in different ways. And they might have a different take on what constitutes a good process or a well-cut garment. So it's very difficult to do that in a way whereby you're transferring a skill, but also allowing people to express themselves as they learn it without losing the underlying methods. There's hundreds of people every year go to colleges and want to be designers. There's no real substitute for experience and on the job training. It's always good to make mistakes on your own. So transferring creative abilities is a real challenge. You need to be patient. It takes about 5 years, a Savile Row apprenticeship. So it takes a while, and you may not think along the same lines as your master. It has to be an element of humility as well to progress, which is a challenge for some, especially this day and age where there isn't such a desire to remain an apprentice for 5 years. You want to get out there and be on your own. But of course, people start a bit later. If you're starting at the age of 15, leaving school a few decades ago, then by the time you're 20, you're a skilled craftsman with a steady career in front of you, which is a real benefit. If you don't have that sort of training when you're very young, you have to do it when you're a little bit older.
Yeah.
And it can feel like a bit of a drag. So it can be a challenge to learn that. There are some really naturally creative and talented people who enter the tailoring trade, and they progress incredibly quickly, but they still have to learn the skills, and it still takes time. Whereas in some areas, in some forms of art, you can be incredibly spontaneously creative and gifted without much training. You know, what I do, you need to learn the skills before you can apply them to your ideas. So there's almost a delaying of the creativity in a way. You might go into the trade thinking, oh, I want to make these beautiful garments. But then you need to learn how to put sleeves into a jacket. takes a long time to learn how to do that. When you've gone through that training process, you've learned the craft, then you can apply that to your career in design. And that's how a lot of well-known designers started on Savile Row. You look at Alexander McQueen, one of the best-known designers on the planet recently. He trained on Savile Row. He had to learn the craft. So I'm having a hand in that transfer of knowledge has been a real privilege to me. I have an assistant at work now who I'm training, an apprentice, if you like, and it's really rewarding seeing them learn. So that is a privilege to be able to pass on a skill like that as well. So I don't think it will die. I don't think you'll lose those skills. A lot of it is preserved in old tailoring books. You can get some beautiful Victorian tailoring manuals, which are huge, heavy, thick things, beautifully illustrated, incredibly detailed. And they're excellent for ideas, for preserving the history of garment style, tailoring methods. A lot of what they outline wouldn't be appropriate to the methods used today. The fabrics are different, the methods have changed, style has changed, people want perhaps a bit more comfort. So that's where the creative side comes in. It's like, well, I want to look like that, but I want to be able to drive my car at the same time. Okay, how do we do that? And that's the creative part of the design process. I enjoy it very much.
As we record this at the end of May 2020, the shop obviously isn't open because of the pandemic. Can you see a way forward at the moment? I mean, it seems to me that it's going to be hard to social distance while you're measuring someone's crotch.
Sure, yeah. There are tailors that have started operating again. Of course, we can make clothes in our workshops. We could do that if we had the work at the moment. Of course, nobody's coming in to buy the clothes. So we are hampered by that being a combined retail and workshop environment. We can't open. We could, if somebody ordered a suit, make the suit. But yes, there is a social distancing problem at the moment, or not a problem. It's necessary, obviously, to employ all the social distancing guidelines, and that is a challenge. There are tailors that have started operating and they are wearing the PPE that's on offer. So if you are fitting a garment on a person, it's very difficult to do it without touching them. In that case, there are tailors who are starting to do that now wearing masks and gloves. Of course, you don't have the dexterity with gloves on. The fabric will slip under the glove. It's very difficult to hold pins. A lot of the time, tailors will put things in their mouths. You've got a load of pins in your mouth and then stick it into a gentleman's shirt. You know, under the current safety guidelines, we have to change our methods, obviously, and that's for the best. And so there are ways of doing it. Obviously, we're not allowed to open our shop, so we can't. But we are planning methods to do that. Of course, when the pandemic has smoothed itself over, there'll still be a demand for what we do. So we want to start again as soon as possible. Main challenge for our company is that 75% of our trade comes from abroad, is exported. So we're seeing gentlemen when we travel. We're essentially travelling tailors in that sense. We go to a hotel, see gentlemen by appointment. And of course, there are a lot of travel restrictions, so it limits what we can do. So as soon as we can see people in our fitting rooms, we'll be fitting them, taking all the necessary precautions.
How many Beatles fans do you think walk past your shop every day? Because I remember I did I did one of these rock and roll walking tours of London, and of course you're just down the road from the former Apple HQ where the Beatles played on the roof, and I remember I walked past your shop and you were in there and you saw me and you've like come out to say hi, but of course like the tour is like carrying on down the road, so I'm sort of like, hi, like I want to talk, but like we're going to look at, you know, Trident Studios or whatever now. So you must get Beatles fans going past every day.
Sure, absolutely. So There was a time when I started working on Savile Row where the doorway to number 5 was always scrawled with graffiti.
Yeah.
Always got tourists popping their names there, and it's largely kept cleaner now. I think that tour guides obviously are encouraged not to do that, and they may have a concierge there that sort of largely keeps more of an eye on it. But before that was smartened up, yeah, covered in graffiti all the time. When I started at Henry Paul, the managing director at the time, who's still working for the company, and I've learned many things from, he was there. He remembers that happening.
Oh, wow.
He remembers working on Savile Row when they were playing on the roof. And it was quite something. Yeah, it was quite something at the time. And what a time that was when the Beatles, on the cover of Abbey Road, three of the Beatles were wearing bespoke tailored garments, Savile Row created garments.
Huh. Is that so?
So, yeah, and the tailor at the time was Tommy Nutter. And the cutters that worked for him are still tailoring. Edward Sexton, Joseph Morgan, they're still bespoke tailors. And yeah, three of the Beatles. I think it was George Harrison is in denim, isn't he?
Yeah.
I believe he was my favourite Beatle. So goodness knows what that says about my career. But those garments were made on Savile Row. Yeah, and a lot of those, Mick Jagger got married in that. Tommy Nutter Savile Row suit, beautiful suit he wore his wedding. So at that time, there was a real desire to be creative with your clothing. And you saw the huge sort of surge in colour, style, the sort of old military chic that they had on these garments in the late 60s, early 70s, that crept in as well. And that was a real heyday for bespoke tailoring. And of course, those garments were considered by some on Savile Row to be a bit garish or frowned upon. You see, I think when Tommy Nutter opened in Savile Row and actually had a window displaying garments, that was considered awfully garish.
Right.
You know, it was a frosted glass and very gentlemanly club-like before then. So that creative period in the 60s really did force Savile Row to adapt and appeal to a changing market in that time. And it still has to do that. It still has to do that. So we're always trying to adapt and improve and change. But the best way to do that is to continue making the best clothes you can. That's what's recognised. If people trust that they're going to get a very finely made garment, they'll come to you to make it. And people that know that and trust that will still come. So I'm confident that we'll do another couple of hundred years. Sure.
So during lockdown, you've been making some music as a kind of creative outlet.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been very interesting. As you're talking about creativity, you asked, do I consider what I do to be creative? And I was thinking about it. Like I said, I consider what I do to be a craft, more like an engineering thing. But interestingly, since I haven't been able to do that, it has left a vacuum, and the creative urges that I obviously release through my career, through my work, through my job, haven't had anywhere to go, and it was frustrating. So yes, picking up a guitar after 10 years of solid tailoring has been really, it's been an excellent release for that energy. So it just goes to show how much of that energy comes out in what I do. Because when I'm busy at work and I'm making garments for people and thinking about fittings, shapes, styles, I don't go home and feel like I want to play 3 hours of guitar like I used to when I was younger. Whereas since I've had to stop working, I literally basically can't work, being I'm furloughed, of course. That energy's got nowhere to go. And it's led to me picking up a guitar. So it just shows that creative energy does come out through my work. And it's now coming out through my music, which has been an interesting thing to discover, because it's not been a frustration as such not playing so much music over the the last 10 years. Whereas before, when I was working in other careers, I'd get home frustrated in that way and sit in my room and write songs and play guitar and write music. I haven't felt the need to when I'm busy tailoring. So that just shows how much of that energy does go through the work. So, yeah, it's good. So when I go back to work, I want to perhaps keep that going in conjunction with my work, not lose, yeah, keep the fingers strong.
Can I include a song at the end of the show?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm going to play Wait Around at the very end of the podcast. So,
well, that'd be a great honour. Thanks, Matt.
Tom, this has been amazing. Thanks so much, buddy.
No problem, Matt. Always a pleasure.
You happy with that, mate?
Yeah, fine. I you know I ran.
That's almost our show. Thanks as always to our guests whose opinions are their own. Please consider subscribing to the show and leaving a review if possible. Don't forget to stay tuned to hear Wait Around by Tom Pendry after the closing credits. There'll be another episode out later this month, going behind the scenes on the making of one of my favourite movies of the year, The Vast of Night. The movie is out now on Amazon Prime, and you might want to watch it before listening to the episode. You can find me on Instagram at Sending Signals Podcast and on Twitter at Signals Podcast. Take care, everyone.